Chapter 12. Tirzak. Tirzak means prison confinement. Tirzak is an official term. In December 1917, it had already become clear that it was altogether impossible to do without prisons, that some people simply couldn't be left anywhere except behind bars. See Chapter 2 above. Simply because there was no place for them in the new society. The attention of the new prison authorities was directed toward the combat readiness of the prison guards outside the walls and the takeover of the stock of prisons inherited from the Tsar. Fortunately, it had turned out that the Civil War had not resulted in the destruction of all the principal central prisons and jails. So we recall the Solovetsky Islands, nicknamed Solovki. It was such a good place, cut off from communication with the outside world for half a year at a time. You couldn't be heard from there no matter how loud you shouted, and you could even burn yourself up for all anyone would know. From our experience of the past and our literature of the past, we have derived a naive faith in the power of a hunger strike. But the hunger strike is a purely moral weapon. It presupposes that the jailer has not entirely lost his conscience, or that the jailer is afraid of public opinion. Only in such circumstances can it be effective. The Tsarist jailers were still inexperienced. They got nervous if one of their prisoners went on a hunger strike. They exclaimed over it. They looked after him. They put him in the hospital. There are many examples, but this work is not about them. It is even humorous to note that it was enough for Valentinov to go on a hunger strike for 12 days. As a result, he not only achieved some relaxation in the regiment, but was totally released from interrogation. Whereupon he went to Lenin in Switzerland. Even in the Oral Central Hard Labor Prison, the strikers always won. They got the regimen relaxed in 1912 and further relaxed in 1913, to the point of general access to outdoor walks for all political hard labor prisoners, who were obviously so unrestricted by their supervisors that they managed to compose and send out to freedom their appeal to the Russian people, and this from the hard labor prisoners of a central prison. Furthermore, it was published. It's enough to make one's eyes pop out of one's head. Someone has to have been crazy. In the revolution of 1905 and the years following it, the prisoners felt themselves to be masters of the prison to such an extent that they did not even go to the trouble of declaring a hunger strike. They simply destroyed prison property, so-called obstructions, or went so far as to declare a strike, although it might seem that for prisoners this would have hardly any meaning. In the 20s, the lively picture of hunger strikes grows clouded, though that depends, of course, on the point of view. Still, it was possible in those years to achieve at least one's personal demands by this means. From the 30s on, state thinking about hunger strikes took a new turn. What did the state want with even such watered-down, isolated, half-suppressed hunger strikes? Wasn't the ideal picture one of prisoners who had no will of their own, nor the capacity to make their own decisions, and of a prison administration that did their thinking and their deciding for them? These are, if you will, the only prisoners who can exist in the new society. And so, from the beginning of the 30s, they stopped accepting declarations of hunger strikes as legal. "The hunger strike as a method of resistance no longer exists," they proclaimed to the Yekaterina Olitskaya in 1932, and they said the same thing to many others. "The government has abolished your hunger strikes, and that's that." But the Olitskaya refused to obey and began to fast. They let her go on fasting in solitary for 15 days. Then they took her to the hospital and put milk and dried crusts in front of her to tempt her. But she stood firm, and on the 19th day she won her victory. She got an extended outdoor period and newspapers and parcels from the political Red Cross. That's how one had to moan and groan in order to receive those legitimate relief parcels. Overall, however, it was an insignificant victory and paid for too dearly. Olitskaya recalls such foolish hunger strikes on the part of others too. People starved up to 20 days in order to get delivery of a parcel or a change of companions for their outdoor walk. Was it worth it? After all, in the new-type prison, one's strength, once lost, could not be restored. The religious sect member, Koliskov, fasted until he died on the 25th day. Could one in general permit oneself to fast in the new type prison? After all, the new prison heads, operating in secrecy and silence, had acquired several powerful methods of combating hunger strikes. 1. Patience on the part of the administration. We have seen enough of what this meant from preceding examples. 2. Deception. This, too, can be practiced thanks to total secrecy. When every step is reported by the newspapers, you aren't going to do much deceiving. But in our country, why not? In 1933, in the Khabarovsk prison, S.A. Chebetaryev, demanding that his family be informed of his whereabouts, fasted for 17 days. He had come from the Chinese Eastern Railroad in Manchuria and then suddenly disappeared, and he was worried about what his wife might be thinking. On the 17th day, Zapadny, the deputy chief of the provincial GPU, and the Khabarovsk prison prosecutor, their ranks indicate that lengthy hunger strikes were really not so frequent, came to see him and showed him a telegraph receipt. There, they said, they had informed his wife, and thus persuaded him to take some broth. And the receipt was fake. 3. Forced artificial feeding. This method was adapted, without any question, from experience with wild animals in captivity, and it could be employed only in total secrecy. By 1937, artificial feeding was, evidently, already in wide use. 4. A new view of the hunger strike. That hunger strikes are a continuation of counter-revolutionary activity in prison and must be punished with a new prison term. Approximately in the middle of 1937, a new directive came. From now on, the prison administration will not in any respect be responsible for those dying on hunger strikes. The last vestige of personal responsibility on the part of the jailers had disappeared. In these circumstances, the prosecutor of the province would not have come to visit Chebetoryev. Furthermore, so that the interrogator shouldn't get disturbed, it was also announced that days spent on hunger strike by a prisoner under interrogation should be crossed off the official interrogation period. In other words, it should not only be considered that the hunger strike had not taken place, but the prisoner should be regarded as not having been in prison at all during the period of the hunger strike. Thus, the interrogator would not be to blame for being behind schedule. Let the only perceptible result of the hunger strike be the prisoner's exhaustion. Decades passed, and time produced its own results. The hunger strike, the first and most natural weapon of the prisoner, in the end became alien and incomprehensible to the prisoners themselves. Fewer and fewer desired to undertake them. And to prison administrations, the whole thing began to seem either plain stupidity or else a malicious violation. Even though the enormous archipelago was already spreading across the land, the prisons for long-termers didn't fall into decay. The old jail tradition was being zealously carried on. Everything new and invaluable which the archipelago had contributed to the indoctrination of the masses was still not enough in itself. The deficiency was provided for by the complementary existence of the TONs, the Special Purpose Prisons, and prisons for long-termers in general. Not everyone swallowed up by the great machine was allowed to mingle with the natives of the archipelago. Individuals who were too famous or who were being held secretly, purged gabesty, could by not any means be seen openly in camps. Their hauling a barrow did not compensate for the disclosure and the consequent moral-political damage. In the same way, the socialists, who were engaged in a continuous struggle for their prison rights, could not conceivably be permitted to mingle with the masses but had to be kept separately and, in fact, suffocated separately, in view of their special privileges and rights. Much later on in the 50s, as we shall learn later in this work, the special purpose prisons were also needed to isolate camp rebels, and in the last years of his life, disappointed in the possibilities of reforming thieves, Stalin gave orders that various ringleaders of thieves should also get the Tirzak rather than camp. And then, to be sure, it was necessary for the state to support free of charge in prison those prisoners who, because of their feebleness, would have immediately died off in camp, and would thus have shirked their duty to serve out their terms. The inventory of old jails, inherited from the Romanov dynasty, was, of necessity, looked after, remodeled, strengthened, and perfected. Certain central prisons, like the one in Yaroslavl, were so well and suitably appointed, doors plated with iron, table, stool, and cot permanently anchored in each cell, that the only thing required to bring them up to date was the installation of muzzles. On the windows and the fencing in of the courtyards where the prisoners walked in order to reduce them to the size of a cell. By 1937, all the trees on the prison grounds had been cut down, all vegetable gardens plowed under, and all grassy areas paved with asphalt. Others, like the one in Sozdal, required new equipment, and the monastery arrangement had to be remodeled, but, after all, self-incarceration of a body in a monastery and its incarceration in a prison by the state serve physically similar purposes, and therefore the buildings were always easy to adapt. One of the buildings of the Sukhanovka Monastery was adapted for use as a prison for long-termers. During the 20s, the prisoners' food was very decent in the isolators for politicals. The lunches always included some meat. Fresh vegetables were served. Milk could be bought in the commissary. In 1931 to 1933, the food deteriorated sharply, but things were no better out in freedom at that time. Both scurvy and dizziness from lack of food were no rarity in the prisons for politicals in those years. Later on, the food improved, but it was never the same as before. The light in cells was always rationed, so to speak, in both the 30s and the 40s. The muzzles on the windows and the frosted reinforced glass created a permanent twilight in the cells. Darkness is an important factor in causing depression. They often stretched netting above the window muzzle, and in the winter it was covered with snow, which cut off this last access to the light. Reading became no more than a way of ruining one's eyes. In the Vladimir TON, they made up for this lack of light at night. Bright electric lights burned all night long, preventing sleep. And in the Dmitrovsk prison in 1938, N.A. Kozyrev, there was a light in the evenings and at night, a kerosene lamp on a little shelf way up near the ceiling that burned away and smoked up the last air. In 1939, there were electric lights that glowed red at half voltage. Air was rationed, too. The hinged panes for ventilation were kept locked, and opened only during the interval of the prisoner's trip to the toilet. In Vladimir in 1948, there was no lack of air, because the transom was open permanently. Walks outdoors ranged from 15 to 45 minutes at various hours in various prisons. There was no such thing as the communication with the soil that had existed in Shulzburg or Solovki. Everything that grew had been torn up by the roots, trampled, covered with concrete and asphalt. They even forbade lifting up one's head to the heavens during the walks. Look at your feet! This was the command both Kozyrev and Adamova remember from the Kazan prison. Visits from relatives were forbidden in 1937 and never renewed. Letters could be sent to close relatives twice a month, and could be received from them in most years. But in Kazan, they had to be returned to the administration the day after they had been read. Access to the commissary to make purchases with the money sent in specifically limited amounts was usually permitted. Furniture was no unimportant part of the prison regimen. Adamova wrote eloquently of her happiness at finding a simple wooden cot with a straw mattress and a simple wooden chair in her cell in Sudzdal, after having only cots that folded into the wall and chairs anchored to the floor. In the Vladimir TON, I, Korniev, experienced two prison regimens. Under one, in 1947 to 1948, personal articles were not removed from the cell. One could lie down during the day, and the turnkey very seldom looked through the peephole. But under the other, in 1949 to 1953, the cell was locked with two locks, the responsibility of the turnkey and duty officer, respectively. One was forbidden to lie down, forbidden to talk in a normal voice, in Kazan only a whisper. Personal articles were all taken away, a uniform of striped mattress ticking was issued, correspondence was permitted only twice a year, and in those days announced without warning by the chief of the prison. Correspondence was permitted only twice a year, and only on those days announced without warning by the chief of the prison. Anyone who missed that day couldn't write. And only a sheet of paper half the size of a postal sheet could be used. Violent searches and unscheduled visits were frequent, requiring the complete turning out of one's belongings and undressing down to one's skin. Communication between cells was prohibited to such an extent that the jailers went through the toilets with a portable lantern after each toilet visit and searched in each hole. The entire cell would get punishment cells for graffiti in the toilets. The punishment cells were a scourge in the special purpose prisons. One could get into a punishment cell for coughing. Cover your head with your blanket, then you can cough. Or for walking around the cell. Kozyrev, it was considered to be rebellious. For the noise made by one's shoes. In the Kazan prison, women had been issued men's shoes that were much too large for women's feet, size 10.5. Incidentally, Ginsburg was correct in concluding that periods in a punishment cell were meted out not for any particular misdemeanor, but according to a schedule. Every prisoner was required to spend some time in there in order to learn what it was like. And the rules included another generally applicable point. In the event of any display of unruliness in a punishment cell, the chief of the prison has the right to extend the term of incarceration there to 20 days. Just what was meant by unruliness? Here's what happened to Kozyrev. The descriptions of the punishment cell and much else in the prison regimen tally to such an extent among all sources that the stamp of a single system of administrative rules can be detected. He was given another 5 days in the punishment cell for pacing back and forth. In the autumn, the building containing the punishment cells was unheated, and it was very cold. They forced prisoners to undress down to their underwear and take off their shoes. The floor was bare earth and dust. It might be wet dirt, and in the Kazan prison it might even be covered with water. Kozyrev had a stool in his. Ginsburg had none in hers. He immediately concluded that he would perish, that he would freeze to death. But some kind of mysterious inner warmth gradually made itself felt, and it was his salvation. He learned to sleep sitting on his stool. They gave him a mug of hot water 3 times a day. It made him drunk. One of the duty officers, in violation of the rules, pressed a piece of sugar into his 10.5-ounce bread ration. On the basis of the rations issued him, and by observing the light from some faraway, tiny, labyrinthine window, Kozyrev kept count of the days. His 5 days had come to an end, but he had not been released. His sense of hearing had become extremely acute, and he heard whispers in the corridor, having to do with either the 6th or 6 days. This was a provocation. They were waiting for him to say that his 5 days were over and that it was time to let him out. That would have constituted unruliness, for which his stay in the punishment cell would have been prolonged. But he sat silent and obedient for another day, and then they let him out, just as if everything had been the way it was supposed to be. Perhaps the chief of the prison used this method for testing all the prisoners in turn for submissiveness, and then he could sentence all those who weren't yet submissive enough to further terms in the punishment cell. After the punishment cell, the ordinary cell seemed like a palace. Kozyrev became deaf for 1/2 a year. He began to get abscesses in his throat. His cellmate went insane from the frequent imprisonment in the punishment cell, and Kozyrev was kept locked up with an insane man for more than 1/2 a year, with just the two of them there. And only here, right here, is where our chapter ought to have begun. It ought to have examined that glimmering light which, in time, the soul of the lonely prisoner begins to emit like the halo of a saint. Torn from the hustle-bustle of everyday life in so absolute a degree that even counting the passing minutes puts him intimately in touch with the universe. The lonely prisoner has to have been purged of every imperfection, of everything that has stirred and troubled him in his former life, that has prevented his muddy waters from settling into transparency. How gratefully his fingers reach out to feel and crumble the lumps of earth in the vegetable garden. But alas, it is all asphalt. How his head rises of itself toward the eternal heavens, but alas, this is forbidden. And how much touching attention the little bird on the windowsill arouses in him, but alas, There is that muzzle there, and the netting as well, and the hinged ventilation pane is locked. And what clear thoughts, what sometimes surprising conclusions, he writes down on the paper issued him. But alas, only if you buy it in the commissary, and only if you turn it into the prison office when you have used it up, for eternal safekeeping. But our peevish qualifications somehow interrupt our line of thought. The pane of our chapter creaks and cracks. We no longer know the answer to the question, is the soul of a person in the new type prison, in the special purpose prison, the TON, purified, or does it perish once and for all? If the first thing you see each and every morning is the eyes of your cellmate who has gone insane, how then shall you save yourself during the coming day? Nikolai Alexandrovich Kozyrev, whose brilliant career in astronomy was interrupted by his arrest, saved himself only by thinking of the eternal and infinite, of the order of the universe, and of its supreme spirit, of the stars, of their internal slate, and what time and the passing of time really are. And in this way he began to discover a new field in physics. And only in this way did he succeed in surviving in the Dmitrovsk prison. But his line of mental exploration was blocked by forgotten figures. He could not build any further. He had to have a lot of figures. Now just where could he get them in his solitary confinement cell with its overnight kerosene lamp, a cell into which even a little bird could enter? And the scientist prayed, "Please, God, I have done everything I could. Please help me. Please help me continue." At this time, he was entitled to receive one book every 10 days. By then, he was alone in the cell. In the meager prison library were several different editions of Demian Bedney's Red Concert, which kept coming around to each cell again and again. Half an hour passed after his prayer. They came to exchange his book, and as usual, without asking anything at all, they pushed a book at him. It was entitled A Course in Astrophysics. Where had it come from? He simply could not imagine such a book in the prison library. Aware of the brief duration of this coincidence, Kozyrev threw himself on it and began to memorize everything he needed immediately, and everything he might need later on. In all, just 2 days had passed, and he had 8 days left into which to keep his book, when there was an unscheduled prison inspection by the chief of the prison. His eagle eye noticed immediately, "But are you an astronomer?" "Yes." "Take this book away from him." But its mystical arrival had opened the way for his further work, which he then continued in the camp of Norilsk. And so now we should begin the chapter on the conflict between the soul and the bars. But what is this? The jailer's key is rattling brazenly in the lock. The gloomy block superintendent is there with a long list. Last name, first name, patronymic, date of birth, article of the code, term, end of term. Get your things together. Be quick about it. Well, brothers and sisters, a prisoner transport. A prisoner transport. We're off to somewhere. Good Lord bless us. Shall we gather up our bones? Well, here's what. If we are still alive, then we'll finish the story another time, in part 5. If we are still alive. End of chapter 12.